Hey, listeners, KJ here. In this episode, you'll hear both me and Serena give a shout out to Author Accelerator's Inside Outlining process. The Inside Outline is a tool that helps you make sure your book has a strong enough spine to support the story you want to tell. It forces you to spot the holes in your character's arc and your story logic before you throw 50,000 words on the page, and it does it without being the kind of outline that feels limiting to writers who prefer to see where the story takes you. Hashtag MWriting listeners have exclusive access to a free download that describes what the outline is, why it works, and how to do it. And if you're writing fiction or memoir, I highly encourage you to grab it and use it before you write, while you're writing, or while you're revising. This thing can help you to give your story the momentum that keeps readers turning pages, and I love it. You'll only find the download at authoraccelerator.com/MWriting.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone trying to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause, and
I'm going to rustle some papers.
Okay.
Now one, two, three. Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Dell'Antonia, and this is Hashtag MWriting. Hashtag MWriting is the weekly podcast about writing all the things, be they fiction, nonfiction, proposals, pitches, essays, freelance work. This is the podcast about sitting down and getting your writing done.
I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and a book I'm just finishing and it's due so soon on preventing childhood substance abuse. And you can also find me at The Washington Post and The Atlantic and The New York Times and places like that.
And I'm Serena Bowen. I'm the author of 30-odd contemporary romance novels, and you can find me at serenabowen.com.
They're not all odd.
Sorry, I just had to.
Some of them, though. Yeah.
I'm so glad you swung
I'm
for
so,
that.
It was so low. It's just hanging there. I am KJ Dell'Antonia. I always hit the softballs, and I am the author of How to Be a Happier Parent, the former editor of the New York Times' Motherload blog. You can still find me as a contributor there. And I'm the author of a novel, The Chicken Sisters, which will be out next summer. And
yay!
That's who we are. And we are downright giddy with joy today for Jess, who is on the downhill slide, the good downhill slide, like, to goodness.
I'm discombobulated. So here's where I am. I'm at the day that we're recording this, I'm 14 days out from my book deadline. I am going to make it. I'm in the stretch. I'm in, you know, that place where nothing else happens. I haven't left the house in days. I am barely getting dressed in the morning. Yesterday, I wrote for 14 hours straight. Literally, all I stopped to do a couple of times was like let the dogs out and grab something that I'd already prepared and stuck in the refrigerator and microwave that. So I'm in a crazy space. But it's also kind of, there's something a little fun about being in that full deep dive, like this is all I think about, and my family's being really lovely. They're cooking for me. They're doing the laundry. I've got a lot of support, so that's great.
Is this?
But it's just funny.
Is this what the last deadline felt like too? I do not remember.
Well, here's the thing. I was talking to someone about that just recently. This is writing a book is like having children. You forget a lot of the worst parts because you know we'd never have children again if we remembered it all. And I handed in Gift of Failure a whole day early. I was very proud of myself. I don't remember it being this bonkers.
I don't remember it being bonkers for you, but I do remember all the bad parts about having children, but I'm not sure I remember the bad parts about you having children.
Well, keep in mind also, I learned a lot from doing Gift of Failure. So a lot of the editing that I had to do after the fact,
right,
I'm now doing before the fact. So like I have this big, it's really funny, every time I compile a chapter in Scrivener and then put it into Word for submitting to our agent and then to later on to the editor, I've got this huge list of things like, have you done this? Have you done that? So when I finish a chapter, it takes me like 2 hours to run all. It's like before the space shuttle launches, what are all the last minute security checks that you have to run? I have this list of, search for all of incidents of, for whatever the word is, recurrences of the word that, and then remove like 50% of them. Have you, used a hyphen the right way? How many commas are in, kind of crazy stuff that just saves Lori from having to, remind me that I overuse the word that. So yeah, there's a lot of my launch codes that have to be run right before I submit. It's definitely, I don't remember feeling this bonkers.
This is your experience of finishing this book. Who knows? Last time, maybe not quite like this. Next time, who knows?
It's interesting. I feel, I did learn a lot last time, and I feel better about what I'm producing this time, simply because last time I didn't know. I was like, I had no idea if my editor was going to come back and say, this is great or this is ridiculously bad, because I had nothing. I had never done it before. I had nothing to judge it against. So this is really a different experience for me in a good way, I think, in that number one, she's seeing chapters as we go along, and I've already gotten feedback on those chapters, and oh my gosh, she loves it, and that makes me so happy. But she's also been able to give me feedback, and I've been able to change direction. So like the chapter I handed in last night is different from the previous three chapters because she'd given me feedback on those previous three chapters, which I'll go back and fix later. But I'm able to make course corrections midway, which has been really great. It's been nice. It has helped me eliminate a lot of work on the other end.
Cool.
So yeah, it's different. The answer to your question is, I think it's different.
It's probably different every time up to a point. And now we turn to the author of some 30-odd books, Serena,
I wanted to ask too.
Is it different every time until it suddenly isn't different, or is it still different every time?
I am trying to make it less the same every time because you and I, KJ, have spent a lot of time lately thinking about outlining.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to shift my whole game towards becoming a better outliner so that I don't have a repeat experience, which is freak out about the ending on every single book.
Well, but one thing I wanted to ask you about is you just recently had like basically what I'm going through right now, except with editing. And that seemed pretty intense for you. Does that stay the same or has that changed? And does it depend on whether you're working with a co-author?
Well, I shot myself in the foot a little bit and set up a month where I had to do edits on two books in the same month. And that was that was just either bad luck or bad planning. Take your pick. But I find it quite exhausting to have to make everything perfect on two books in a row, where you don't give yourself the fun part of drafting and inventing in between to like break up the tedium of perfection.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, when I was doing the big edit of my novel, I couldn't draft. I thought I was going to be able to. Like, I was totally, if you go back, 8 podcasts, I'm like, I'm going to do both. I'm going to edit a little every day and I'll write a little every day. And that lasted a week, mostly because the editing was just more intense. But yeah, the drafting, I don't know. Drafting is fun sometimes. Editing is fun sometimes. Making things perfect, maybe not so much.
Not so much.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, the 14 hours I spent yesterday were sort of a combination of the two. Mainly it was editing, which can be really, tedious and all that stuff. But yesterday I did get to have one of those moments yesterday when it got a little buzzy where I was like, oh, I like that. I got to have those even in the editing process. In fact, I changed how the chapter ended, and I had one of those sort of moments where it feels like the minor chord changes to a major chord, and there's that big breath you can take at the end, and you're like, it works. It was really a nice moment, and that happened in editing, so that was really fun. Yeah,
I don't think I have ever had an experience of writing that feels like what I hear you reflecting. So part of me is sitting thinking, should I be writing for 14 hours a day? That's not something that's ever been. I've had a full-time writing job that sometimes took that, but I wouldn't have been writing the whole time. I would have been, you know, writing and editing and screaming and coding and frantically, you know, going through the comments and all the other things. I have never, the intensity with which you are writing right now is not something that I have ever experienced.
Okay, here's the thing though. It's not about the intensity and it's not about the amount of time. The only, and this is really helpful information for me, the only times I have gotten this really serious, it's like a runner's high kind of thing, a writer's high. It's a writer's high. And the times I get it reliably are when I'm writing creative nonfiction. It happened when I wrote for creative nonfiction, that piece that I've taught monsters. It's happening in this book. And the good news is that my editor is encouraging me to write more that way and less like research papery, which is great because I get less of it when I write that sort of sciencey kind of stuff. But it's nice to know that there is this genre that gives me writer's high. And it's the stuff I like to read the most. So, you know, it's kind of like knowing what your sweet spot is. So for me, it's a genre.
And that is the perfect segue into the topic which I have gathered us here today to discuss, which is
good.
What we write, how much we sort of choose that and how much it chooses us and how we feel about it, which is a very complicated way of saying that I had a crisis of confidence last week in which I sort of sat down on the bed convinced that the fact that I do not and will not and never going to write literary fiction basically meant that I, you know, had wasted my entire education and all the things. So yeah.
Well, well done yeah, you. Well done that must have been fun.
Well, I have a crisis of confidence, you know, pretty much every day at noon.
Is it on the schedule?
Yeah, there's no sticker.
Time blocking, right? Yeah. I wouldn't call it a crisis.
Those would be fun stickers, though.
It's not. I like the book that I wrote, and I like How to Be a Happier Parent, and I like, you know, I like the work that I do, and I like the experience that I have doing it. But I have frequently had the experience of feeling like I should be doing something else. When I spent, you know, years writing about parenting for the New York Times, that parenting has to be, of all the subjects that the New York Times thinks are, you know, like, it was the gutter of New York Times writing when mm-hmm. I was doing it, and maybe that the experience has changed, but, you know, it wasn't something really important like sports or, okay, forget that, but it wasn't busy. I hated that. That made me so mad. You know, whole sections, editors, develop, anyway. It wasn't like finance. It wasn't politics, although it frequently was finance and it frequently was politics. I just would often feel like, you know, a smart person should be doing something else. And I'm having a little bit of that same feeling, you know, contemplating my undeniably fun romp of a book, which I enjoyed writing and is exactly the kind of thing that I like to read. But then I just sort of think, well, I mean, should I? You go to the bookstore right now and everything is sort of really deep and dark and meaningful and apocalyptic. And that's,
well,
it's not what I did.
I'm sorry. I have some things to say.
Please, say the
Well, first of all, my ghetto is located down the alleyway, you know, past a flap of tattered burlap, you know, from your ghetto. Because, you know, and romance writers are very accustomed to being in a ghetto that is ghettoier than everyone else's. And in fact, I remember this hilarious essay that Jennifer Weiner wrote for the New York Times a couple years ago about going to the Princeton reunion as a commercial fiction author. And I remember tweeting to her like, well, you know, I sometimes roll up to the Yale reunion as a writer of occasionally erotic romance. And so, you know, my ghetto mocks your ghetto. But and the funny thing is that Jennifer Weiner, I love her so much. And she, you know, her favorite book of mine is a work of gay romance. So she totally gets it. It was just a funny moment. And romance authors are very much accustomed to this idea of you're not a real author, even if you're making six figures, because there's a guy's chest on the cover of your book. And we all have days where that doesn't seem fair, or, you know, you get the weird look from the mom at the soccer game. But I always tell people who are struggling with this that when you write some amazing line of dialogue, or that thing that happened in chapter two comes back as the perfect call out in chapter nine, it doesn't matter what you're writing that in. You feel just as good about it either way. When it works, it works.
Well, and in the end, you're a storyteller. I mean, the whole point of being a writer is to express yourself in stories. And frankly, KJ, I was going to say this before, if you were writing stuff that you have told me on this podcast that there are whole awards for literary stuff that are out there that automatically mean they're books that you're not going to like. Yep. And you don't want to be trying to write that stuff because it would stink, because you don't like writing it. You don't even like reading it.
This is not like make me feel better about myself. I feel fine. I'm super excited about my book. I'm in some ways more excited about it than I was about the nonfiction that I think it's just new and it feels exciting and it's super fun. It's something I've always wanted to do. It's funny how I think we all do this to ourselves. We used to have a thread when I was part of The Well, which was an early salon community. And we had this thread called I'll Be a Real Writer When. And I mean, the people that weighed in on that, I won't call anybody out, but you'd recognize names. They were real writers then. Yeah, this was 15 years ago. It's funny how I think we all have a should. And do you have a should at all? Or do you just, and what you write is pretty classy.
Me? Yeah. I mean, for me, every single time I write something because the stuff I really like to write about has to do with like children's welfare and, ways prisons could be better and help kids. I mean, I really do love writing that stuff. And the problem with that stuff is that not a lot of people care, even though it's about kids or whatever. You know, as soon as you start talking about prisons or something, people are like, yeah, whatever. I mean, I get upset that kind of stuff doesn't, that I don't write that stuff more because I feel like I should, because that feels like if I were really doing my job and using the bullhorn that I have because I'm lucky enough to have an audience, I need to be writing stuff that's more worthy, blah, blah, blah. And so that can be really tough because sometimes I just want to write an essay about fishing with my dad. So yeah, I feel that too. Like, should I be using these words to help kids be better, or do I get to just enjoy writing? So yeah.
I had an idea for a new question we should ask everyone that comes on the podcast, and it's, what do you write when you write in your head? You know what I mean? Like, aren't we all wandering around?
Yeah, that's
like,
a good question.
James Thurber used to tell a possibly apocryphal story about how his wife would walk up to him at parties and say, James, stop writing. So
oh, for me, it's definitely... It's definitely creative nonfiction. I just thought about it. And I'm writing in my head all day long.
But are you writing essays or are you writing like opinions?
No, definitely essays. Yeah.
Serena, what do you write when you write in your head?
Well, I always am happy to admit that I am a little bit trapped in romance at the moment because I have a platform. And the bigger it gets, the harder it is for me to find tons of enthusiasm for striking out in a new direction.
And you're kind of good at it.
Well, thank you.
She's also incredibly good at YA too, which is, you know, that my favorite book of yours happens to be a YA novel called The Accidentals.
I actually really love YA and I would like to write more of it. But and The Accidentals was, you know, a really good time for me to write. But the thing about YA, though, is that I don't love where the market for it is right now. Mm-hmm. And so very objectively, I, you know, am not sorry that I'm not trying to sell something into that space right now. I might next year, perhaps, but but not because I think the market will be any better next year. I don't love the direction of the young adult market and what's happening with it. So even though I feel suited to write it, even potentially better suited than I am to romance, it's that would be a really tough decision to make.
Yeah. KJ, what do you write in your head?
Sometimes, you know, rants about I'm not sure. So I'm not necessarily sure that the question reflects like what we, so I think it also reflects what we sort of are accustomed to write. I write essays in my head.
Okay.
Sometimes they're angry, ranty essays, and sometimes they turn into actual essays, and sometimes they turn into actual angry, ranty essays. I recently penned in an epic called Why Salad Is Just Too Hard. And I'm hoping you might be reading it somewhere soon, because some days salad is just too hard.
Yeah.
And it's hard to make, it's hard to eat, it's hard to slice, it's hard to, so anyway.
That's really funny.
I might just be insane when I write in my head.
Actually, it's funny. I'm not going to talk about the details, but on the personal side, besides writing this book, there's a lot that's going on right now in my life, and there's a lot I want to remember about what's going on in my life right now. Like there have been some funny and tragic and weird things that have happened, and it's been really frustrating for me not to have the extra time to sit down and write a lot of that down. So I've had to just jot down notes, but that's the stuff I've been writing in my head because I need to process that stuff, and the way I process is by writing creative nonfiction essays about it in my head. So it's really weird. It's sort of like I'm constantly sorting through the weirdness of my life in terms of creative nonfiction essays. It's very bizarre.
So you're saying you have an inner David Sedaris?
Yeah, I guess I have thought about it that way. And also feeling bad that I don't have time to do what the crazy manic thing he does every day, obsessively, you know, writing notes and then transcribing those notes. Because ideally, that's what I would be doing right now if I had time, because so much is happening in my personal life right now that I'm afraid I'm going to forget that if this was a perfect world, I would have 2 hours a day to process my notes into writing that I would then do something with eventually down the line. But I don't have time.
Yeah, I feel like you can only mentally do that if your day job is bartending. David Sedaris' day job is bartending. I'm not saying that, but it's like if you're writing all day, then to sort of sit down and also, you know, write the other stuff is really hard.
This happened during Gift of Failure too. I'm out of words. Although during Gift of Failure, somehow I was writing a column every 2 weeks too, and I don't know how that worked. I honestly have no memory of it. I've blocked it out. So anyway, can I tell a story about, since we're talking about people who have had a crisis of confidence, I have a cool story. About a book I read recently. So there was this article in The Guardian that just killed me. It was so good. It was written by Allison Flood. It was in The Guardian recently about an author named Adrian McKinty. And Adrian McKinty has been in the media recently because he has a book called The Chain that was really a fun listen. I really liked it. And I was curious about what this guy's all about, because it turns out he's written a bunch of mysteries in the past. He's been an author for a long time. He's written a lot of stuff that got critical acclaim, but just no one else read it, apparently. So there's this article in The Guardian, and it's called From Uber Driving to Huge Book Deal, Adrian McKinty's Life-Changing Phone Call. And get this. So Adrian McKinty has decided to give up. He's decided, I can't support my family as an author. He's Uber driving. He's working a couple of jobs just to make ends meet. Even though his books have gotten great reviews and critical acclaim, he's giving up. And so he had mentioned this to Don Winslow, huge author Don Winslow, at a conference. And so Don Winslow, this freaks Don Winslow out, because Don Winslow has been through something like this, a similar situation, and he doesn't want Adrian McKinty to give up. So Don Winslow tells his agent, Shane Salerno, that Adrian McKinty is giving up writing. And Shane Salerno calls Adrian McKinty and says, Don tells me you've given up writing And I just don't think you should do that. And have you thought about writing a book set in the U.S., blah, 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 blah. And so Adrian McKinty has had an idea for a book. And so he writes 30 pages of it, like bangs out 30 pages of this book that he'd been thinking about. And at around 3 a.m, you know, he hands it in. And at 4:15, the phone rings. And here's what Shane Salerno, agent to Don Winslow, says, quote, "Forget bartending. Forget driving a bloody Uber," Salerno said. "You're writing this book." And he's like, "No, I can't. I can't support my family." He gets an offer of, you know, some short-term financial support from Shane Salerno. He's like, "You need some money, you know, just to get by so you can write this thing. I'll help." Anyway, he writes the book. He gets a huge book deal for it, and then an even huger film deal. He got a six-figure deal for The Chain and a seven-figure deal for The Chain in as a film. So, yeah, he didn't quit.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a crazy story. It's just nuts. But
I'll
also
bet at some point he was like, and it's just thrillers. If I were a really smart graduate of whatever I'm a smart graduate of, I would probably be writing literary fiction and really not supporting my family.
Well, what was cool about it also is that he had this idea for these two. It's sort of like when Stephen King talks about how he got the idea for Carrie. It was these two ideas that didn't work on their own, but when they came together, bang, there's a plot. So he had this thing kind of marinating in there. But, you know, he pushed back pretty hard. He's like, nope, I'm done. No, really, really. Shane Salerno, agent to Don Winslow. And there's also a nice moment when, you know, when he gets the film deal, McKinty says to Salerno, "I said, mate, you should have told me to sit down first. Can you say it all again really slowly as if you're talking to an idiot?" Yeah, so anyway, it was a cool story.
That is a gorgeous story. And a good book, you're saying?
The Chain is, you might not love it. It's people in peril sort of stories. But
not my fave.
A very cool idea. This is not a spoiler because it's right there on the book, but essentially your kid gets kidnapped and the only way your kid gets returned is if you kidnap another kid and so on. And
pay a ransom.
Yeah, it's and pay
when
a ransom.
When I first heard the idea for it, I was like, well, wait, how does that?
Yeah, no, Bitcoin
ransom.
As a
kidnapper, just don't feel that's a scalable business model.
It is a very good business model, actually, because the chain self-regulates itself and self-disciplines, because if someone does something wrong, the punishment goes back down the chain. So anyway, it's going to make a killer movie. I can only, and no pun intended, it's going to make a great movie, and it's just compulsively readable. Listenable, actually. I listened, and it was a great listen. So anyway, cool story.
So are we on what we're reading?
Well, I don't know. Would we like to talk about what happened with the New York Times book lists?
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Speaking of ghettos and having your ghettos sort of semi-recognized, but not really, but kind of.
I sent you a text this morning that was, guys, look, an article. And the Times is changing their list. Who would like to take this one? Serena, you would like to? Serena, KJ texted back, yay or something. And Serena texted back something like, eh. So Serena, what was your response?
My response was that this isn't even news. Because what they've expanded is that they brought back something they cut more than a year ago, which was the mass market paperback list used to be a weekly list. And they also cut graphic novels at exactly the same time. So bringing it back as a monthly is a non-event, especially because in what sells in mass market paperback is a lot of romance and genre fiction.
Okay, so Serena, for our listeners who may not be as familiar, I would say, Serena, why aren't you super excited about that? Mass market means romance. Why aren't you excited?
Because the romance market keeps moving further and further away from mass market fiction. So they cut it at the moment when it could have made a difference, and now it's just not interesting.
Anyone who may not know, what does mass market mean?
They actually haven't changed it on their web. Like the lists still look the same because I was just trying to.
Right.
Yeah.
It said the new lists don't even hit print until the end of October. But so mass market is those rack sized books that they have at the grocery store. Mm-hmm. And the market for those fundamentally changed a few years ago when the distribution company that was handling most of them stopped doing their business. And then publishers began to move away from mass market paperback and into the trade size, which is the slightly larger paperback you mostly see on tables if you go to a bookstore. So mass market gets two kinds of releases. They get some romance releases just straight up. It'll be like ebook and that. Or it's like a, if you have a mega bestseller, then you might also get a pocket-sized release after your regular paperback release, just, you know.
I'll bet the chain gets a pocket-sized release.
Yeah, so by adding this, it's a really strange decision because there aren't that many books that come out in mass market anymore, and the romance ones are selling most of their copies in ebook form. So when I read this change, I thought, oh, the New York Times is trying to make a nod toward romance without having to touch anything that's independently published. Like, they basically are holding up a sign that says, self-published do not apply.
Here's a question, though. If they added an ebook, well, I guess if they added, they do have an ebook list, and so that wouldn't include self-published books then, is what you're saying.
Well, the ebook, it's called Combined Fiction, is the list that they have. They don't have an ebook bestseller list anymore that's just for ebooks, because it would have lots and lots of self-published things on it, and they didn't like that, so they got rid of it.
Well, that's a of indignation then.
Yeah, I was going to say, there is no ebook list anymore.
Nope, there was, but there isn't anymore. And
speaking of, you know, ghettos and not recognized, and I will also just note that they pulled their parenting list at the same time they pulled the graphic novels, and they didn't even restore that one. They're not even pretending. If you don't manage to make advice and how to, which some people do, you're not, and yeah, you're still,
well,
you're,
and that's going to really affect, that's going to affect how publishers market books too, because, you know, is my next book a parenting book? Is it an advice or how to? Well, if I'm a smart publisher and I want it to make the list, I'm going to make sure I push it as an advice or how to, which is going to, you know, it's just a weird, like if I go into a bookstore looking for Gift of Failure, it's never in the advice or how to, it's in the parenting section. But if I were releasing that now, I would say, well, we need to really push this as an advice or how to.
I don't think, maybe I'm woefully misinformed here, but well, no, it is weird. But I think advice, how to, and miscellaneous incorporates all the other. So it does incorporate parenting.
Yeah,
it's just not a specific. So now it's going to, and it also has always, and now it'll have to incorporate sports and science too. I guess, although they call those nonfiction. Who knows?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what I do now.
Okay,
I'm not making
that?
This list. Serena's not making this list. But, you know, and you got a shot, although you've chosen a harder topic this time around.
Yeah.
Should go back to those
kids
failing.
We acknowledge that from the beginning.
Really, if this is all you want in life.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Oh, well.
Oh, well. Thanks, New York Times, for giving it a shot. All right, let's just, since I talked about the chain, so why don't you guys talk? Oh, and can I also just mention really quickly, since we're going to talk about what we're reading, so when I'm in this crazy place, like I am right now with this book, the thing that has been really, it's been really hard for me to find moments to calm down and relax, and I have been re-listening to Jane Austen, but specifically, so I had been listening to Rosamund Pike read the Pride and Prejudice. It's a really, really great version of Pride and Prejudice, read by Rosamund Pike, who had played the sister Jane in the film, in one of the film versions of it. But now I'm listening to Sense and Sensibility, read by the actress Juliette Stevenson, and it's really lovely. And the nice thing about it is my mind can wander because I already know the stories by heart, but it also, it's like, you know, it's like having a story. It's like when you're a little kid and when your kids are really, really little and they love having the same story read over and over and over again. I think that's soothing in some, on some very primal level for me. So that's what I've been listening to.
Stuff that lets your mind wander is really good.
Yeah.
Like for that, I've been re-listening to something that I have listened to twice already, partly just for that. Like I don't know. I need something to make sounds in my head so that I'm not hearing this. Some of the reason I had to listen to it was that one of my children was compelled to memorize the Declaration of International Human Rights or something along those lines. And said child required both an audience and to do that out loud, but did not actually require you to listen. So, earbuds. That's what I have to say about that particular experience. I do have some books, but Serena, you want to go? Are you first?
Yeah, I just bought a hardcover copy of Things You Save in a Fire by Catherine Center, because not only did KJ like this book, but she told me that I would love it.
That was the one. I was sitting here before the podcast going, I know I read something I really liked recently. What did I read? That was what it was. Found it. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Now I have to change mine.
What is that?
So I read this book called Things You Save in a Fire. No.
What is Things You Save in a Fire? Is it nonfiction? Is it fiction? What's happening there?
You know, it is flat out romance that has been marketed as commercial women's fiction. And it is that as well. But I see nothing about the story that violates the genre rules of romance. It is not one of those things where there are two people and only one of them gets her. We've talked about this before. The line is interesting and strange. And this one is a clear, fun, rollicking trip to the HEA.
Okay.
That would be the happily ever after.
So it's not going to give me any guidance about what I should save if my house catches on fire.
No. How to and miscellaneous, it is not.
All right. Sorry, KJ. What have you been reading?
I just besides told you that. That's it.
Okay,
I read that.
Excellent.
I really liked it. It was really good. She has an amazing Instagram feed too, people. Her name is Catherine Center, and she is an artist as well as a writer. So she paints on the books, which is killer. And as a doodler, I'm thinking, you know, I feel I'm going to doodle on my books. I'm going to doodle chickens on my books for Instagram, and I cannot wait to do it.
Oh, that's cool. A really cool idea. I like it. I can't wait. I can't wait. I have a cool bookstore for this week.
Please.
So when we first moved to Vermont, of course, I had to go looking for, you know, all the independent bookstores in the area. And I've talked about some of them, but I have not talked about this lovely little one. There is a little town near us called Shelburne that has the sweetest little sort of town center. There's a gorgeous museum that has all these old buildings from all over Vermont and New England that have been restored and are on. It's just a beautiful museum. And across the street from that pretty much is this little village. It's really cute. And in that village is a lovely little bookstore called the Flying Pig Bookstore. It is small, but it is lovely, and they really know their books. And I have been trying to order my books through there because it is I can ride my bike to it, which is nice. It's always – and I have a little basket on the front of my bike, and so I have this very romantic vision of riding to my local bookstore and picking up my books and putting them in the basket of my bike. So, yeah, these are the kind of things I live for at the moment. So – I highly recommend it.
Sounds great. I think you should take us there, you know, when we see you next.
Sounds good.
But without the bicycles and the baskets.
I could put you guys
in my basket. I love that vision. I'd like to see you doing that. Maybe with some flowers woven through the basket.
I actually took a picture
of
my dog.
My bike. Ooh, can Coco the pug ride in the basket?
I'm so far ahead of you. It turns out that baskets in the front have a weight limit, and pugs are just at the top end of that weight limit. But you actually had this thing you had in your car for Blackberry. It's a little
bucket. I might have a bike basket for my poodle.
You also had this thing in your car, and I was envisioning something like this for the front of my bike. It's like a box that she sits in, and she's also attached to a seatbelt, because I definitely would need to strap Coco in on the front of my bike.
Yes.
Because if she saw something she wanted to attack and kill, which happens often, she would leap right out of the front of the bike. But I have already envisioned the whole scenario and have tried to come up with ways to reinforce my current bike basket so that I could stick the pug in there. But yeah, I'm way ahead of you.
A diet for the pug. I see. There's a good reason. That's a good cause. Yeah, they do make a basket for the front of the bike that has a little thing that clips to the collar of the dog in question.
Yeah.
And I do own it, although I do not think, I have
Blackberry
ever.
Blackberry's lighter than cocoa. So
much. Yeah. Yes. And I don't think she would mind being placed in it, but I don't know that I have. And yes, I do have that thing for the car, but the reason that I have it has nothing to do with the dog's safety or comfort and everything to do with the dog's strong preference for riding in my lap, which has a lot to do with my personal safety and comfort.
Right.
Which right, so this exactly, is a podcast about right. riding around with your dogs in vehicles.
Yeah,
next
exactly.
week, trains, airplanes.
All right, are we good, people? Are we there? Have we done our job this week?
I think we have. And let me just say that if you agree and think that we have done our job, we hope you'll head over to amridingpodcast.com. Sign up for our weekly email in which we tell you all, well, in which you get a transcript of all the things about riding around with your dog in the car and possibly some more useful things as well. And if you really love the podcast and crave more useful things, you can sign up for our Rider Top Fives at the same place. That's a subscription service, supports the podcast, which is and always will be free, and also enables you to get our Rider Top Five lists every Monday. We've got coming up, we've got Top Five Reasons You Should Do NaNoWriMo. We've had Top Five Questions You Should Ask Your Fictional Character, Top Five Reasons You Should Be on Instagram. We got Top Five Ways to make your reader laugh. Coming soon, top five.
The burn chart one was great. And I can say that because I have nothing to do with them because, as I may have already mentioned, I have no other time to do anything but write this book. So this is all you two. And I am so impressed with what you guys have done with these top five. They've been fantastic. I've enjoyed
Thank
them
you.
As a reader that has nothing to do with them at the moment, but I will
you
at
will.
Some point
you
soon.
You will. Yep. Your time will come.
Yep.
Your time will come. All right. Yeah. So, head over to amridingpodcast.com. Check us out. Support us. Subscribe to us. And of course, as always, subscribe to us and rate us, should you care to, on iTunes, Tunes, or wherever you listen to your podcast.
All right.
You can still do the ending.
Okay, cool. I love the ending. All right, everyone. Until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. This episode of Hashtag AmWriting with Jess and KJ was produced by Andrew Perella. Our music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and performed by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their services because everyone, even creatives, should be paid for their work.
Same.